Micah chapter 3.
Listen, you leaders of Jacob, you rulers of Israel, should you not embrace justice? You who hate good and love evil, who tear the skin from my people and the flesh from their bones, who eat my people's flesh, strip off their skin and break their bones in pieces, who chop them up like meat for the pan, like flesh for the pot. Then they will cry out to the Lord, but he will not answer them. At that time he will hide his face from them because of the evil they have done. This is what the Lord says. As for the prophets who lead my people astray, they proclaim peace. If they have something to eat, but prepare to wage war against anyone who refuses to feed them. Therefore night will come over you without visions, and darkness without divination. The sun will set for the prophets, and the day will go dark for them. The seers will be ashamed, and the diviners disgraced. They will all cover their faces because there is no answer from God. But as for me, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord, and with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his transgression, to Israel his sin. Hear this, you leaders of Jacob, you rulers of Israel, who despise justice and distort all that is right, who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with wickedness. Her leaders judge for a bribe, her priests teach for a price, and her prophets tell fortunes for money. Yet they look for the Lord's support and say, "Is not the Lord among us? No, disaster will come upon us." Therefore, because of you, Zion will be ploughed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, the temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war any more. Everyone will sit under their own vine and under their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. All the nations may walk in the name of their gods, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever.
Lots of the young people from this church go on a summer camp each year called Colwyn Bay 3 or CB3. And Dan, who is preaching for us this evening and is now sitting up in the balcony looking slightly nervous because he's wondering why he's in this intro, Dan is a very important bloke on that camp. He runs it, basically. In fact, at numerous points during the week, he runs it single-handedly. And therefore, if you ever came on camp, you might well think, okay, well, I want to stay on the right side of Dan. I want to please him. I want to keep Dan happy. And at that point, you might think about asking Dan what he would like you to do for him, or how you could be most helpful and listening to the response. Or you might think, well, I rather think I know what Dan is like. I don't really need him to tell me. I can win him round my own way. And if you thought like that, well, you might think, I'm sure that Dan is a fan of sandwiches. And here we are, we're in Colwyn Bay, we're by the seaside, so I know what I'll do. I'll make Dan a really nice big tuna sandwich. That's what I'll do. Now, you all ought to be aware at this point that tuna is Dan's kryptonite. If you go within 2 meters of Dan with tuna, he recoils in terror and loses all his powers. And so, lovely though your tuna sandwich plan might sound, it is a disaster. You're not going to ingratiate yourself to him that way. In fact, you might damage your relationship with him irreparably. And all because you thought you knew him when really you didn't. And you didn't bother to find out. Which brings us to the book of Micah. There is a big question which frames the whole book of Micah, and that is the question, who is like God? That is actually what Micah's name means. Literally, who is like Yahweh, which is God's covenant name. So in one sense, that question is there right up front in the book. And it's the question that Micah poses as he comes to conclude his book in chapter 7, verse 18. Who is a God like you? And the question, who is like Yahweh? Well, that presupposes another vital question. And that is the question, what is Yahweh, what is God like? You see, if God is to be recognized and rightly acknowledged, to be approached in his uniqueness, then God must be known as he really is. Not just as people might suppose him to be or wish him to be. And as we come to Micah's book, we need to recognize that God's people in his day, in that regard, were in serious trouble. I mean, they're in serious trouble in a number of ways. Their internal affairs were a mess, as we see in today's reading in chapter 3. They also faced a very serious threat from the powerful, aggressive Assyrian Empire who were chomping away on the border. But most of all, they were in trouble because they had lost sight of who their God was and what he is like. And so Micah was sent to remind them. More than this is a book about anything else, Micah is a book about God, about who he is, and therefore about what he does, about what he cares about what he wants of his people, what he wants for his people. Now, in recent weeks, we've looked at chapters 1 and 2 on Sunday evenings. But today and next week, here in Sunday morning, we're going to cover the next three chapters, chapters 3 to 5. And those are actually two separate chunks of the book, verses chapters 1 and 2, chapters 3 and 5. They represent two of the three cycles that you get in the book of Micah, the other obviously being chapters 6 and 7. The book consists in these three cycles, each beginning with the command to listen or to hear. We find that in 1 verse 2, 3 verse 1, and 6 verse 1. We saw it this morning. Then I said, listen, you leaders of Jacob. And each of those cycles follows the same pattern. In each of them, Micah declares that judgment is coming. But then he goes on to show that through judgment, beyond judgment, there is great hope. And we see that pattern, we see that movement of hope on through and beyond judgment played out in the section we're in this morning, which Aaron read for us in chapter 3 and the start of chapter 4. And in particular here, we see the significance of that shift from judgment for what is happening now and the hope that there is in God for the future with regard to the issue of leadership. That is the big issue that is in view in this section. And that's that pattern that we see in these cycles from judgment through to hope. That isn't just a structural thing. That isn't just how Micah has decided to arrange his book. No, it serves to draw out a key point of contrast for us. And we see that here today on the issue of leadership. We'll see this morning that whereas human leadership is horribly flawed, totally inadequate, in chapter 3, such that life under it constitutes deathly misery. Well, so life under God's leadership, well, that is untarnished bliss, as we see in the first five verses of chapter 4. And the fact that the two are put side by side, of course, just increases for us the clarity with which we see the goodness of God's leadership. Who knows what will happen in the future in North Korea? But just imagine if the current regime were to fall and what came in its place was brilliant. I mean, just exceptionally good government. Open, fair, just, producing growth and peace and stability. In any situation in the world, that kind of government is good news. But there, by comparison to what had gone before it, it would just serve to highlight, just serve to magnify quite how good, just what a difference such leadership makes. There'd be no missing the quality of those responsible. The whole world would see and know. Well, so Micah in chapters 3 and 4 stands up such a contrast so that there might be no missing the difference that true leadership makes. And there might be no missing the fact that only God can offer such true leadership. And to see that that is offered to us as we recognize who God really is and what he is really like. So let's get into it a little bit, beginning with the bad news, the very bad news in chapter 3. Michael exposes for us in this chapter 3 particularly shocking aspects of what is going on in Israel and Judah in his day. Firstly, he does so in verses 1 to 4, where we see the biting injustice of the rulers. Let me read verses 1 to 3 again for us, with apologies to the squeamish. Then I said, "Listen, you leaders of Jacob, you rulers of Israel, should you not embrace justice, you who hate good and love evil, who tear the skin from my people and the flesh from their bones, who eat my people's flesh, strip off their skin and break their bones in pieces, who chop them up like meat for the pan, like flesh for the pot." In chapter 2, we heard how those who plot to, sorry, we heard about those who plot to defraud, to take from others their land and inheritance. And here in these verses, we catch a further ugly glimpse at how such wrongdoing is allowed to happen, how in fact it is allowed to prosper. Because the justice system doesn't make it difficult for those who are out to wrong others, it makes it possible. Now, if you were here for the first sermon we had on Micah, you remember that I did warn you in that Micah doesn't pull his punches. He really wants his readers to recognize the seriousness of the situation. And we see that here. The imagery he uses is absolutely visceral. The intention is vitriolic. It is a metaphor intended to bring revulsion. We are supposed to be disgusted by what we read. Now, obviously, the point is not literal. It's not that the leaders in Judah had taken to cannibalism. But the point it makes, well, that is deadly real. The leaders may have thought that their crimes were kind of administrative. It was all very white collar. You know, fiddling the legal system here, a little bit of money, exchanging hands, a few brown envelopes. But the kind of the warping of the judicial process, nobody actually getting hurt. But the effect, of course, of what they were doing, well, that was to leave people utterly destitute, materially and physically desperate. They perish, the poor and the needy in the land perish, while the rulers get fat off the back of them. And Micah graphically suggests, therefore, that given that that's the case, it is just as if they had butchered, cooked, and consumed them themselves. They might as well have. When you look at the outcomes, Micah says, when you look at where, how they run things, how the justice system works or fails to work as it should, well, the outcome is a horror show either way. And then we come to verse 4. Then they will cry out to the Lord, that is the rulers, that is the unjust leaders, but he will not answer them. At that time, he will hide his face from them because of the evil they have done. It is a terrifying thought. A day will come when, despite their arrogance, their conceited belief that they, as the makers and enforcers of the law, were somehow above the law, well, they will realize that they are not, that they answer to a higher authority. When it talks there of them crying out and not being heard, it isn't talking about genuine repentance, but about a day of dreadful realization. I imagine in courts in this country, there are many who change their plea once the verdict is delivered in a desperate attempt to receive clemency. But it is too late by then. The judge will not hear you as you are led off to the cells, having been pronounced guilty. Just as they, in injustice, refused to listen to the cries of those who came before them innocent to plead their case. Well, so in the end, God will refuse injustice to listen to them in their guilt. The second bleak aspect of the leadership in the land is then laid out for us in verses 5 to 8. The problem is stated there in verse 5. This is what the Lord says. As for the prophets who lead my people astray, they proclaim peace if they have something to eat, but prepare to wage war against anyone who refuses to feed them. You can picture the scene. There are a couple of people sitting in a waiting room, nervously looking at one of those little sort of ticker screens for their name to flash up. And on the door, there's a sign which reads, "The office of Ziza, son of Kish, prophet of the Lord." There's a little buzz, and a name flashes up. The first person gets up, picks up the large basket of muffins that they've brought with them, and heads on in. A few minutes later, the door opens and the person emerges, a broad smile on their face. "Thank you, yes, great, thank you, yes, of course, I'll book another appointment in a few weeks." They shut the door, they glance at the other person. They say, "He's really very good, you know. It's all going to turn out smelling of roses." Another little buzz, another name comes up. The second gets up and heads in, empty-handed. A few minutes later, after a fair amount of shouting, they rush out of the door in floods of tears and dash away. The prophet comes to the door, scowling and shaking his head. "Now," he says, "where are those muffins?" The prophets don't care what God does and doesn't say. They care what kind of payoff is in it for them. They're not so much spokespeople for God as fortune cookie vending machines. And as a result, in verses 6 and 7, night, darkness, the sun will set, the day will go dark, shame, disgrace, they will all cover their faces because there is no answer from God. The particular tragedy in these verses is the fact that they really could have heard God. He really would have spoken to them such that they could speak for him to others if they had cared to ask and listen. But as it is, they have turned their back on God. And so God will remove himself and his word from them. He will leave them in darkness and silence. Having spoken falsely in his name, they will hear nothing. And they stand in contrast to Micah. We know from chapter 2 that Micah is not popular with the other prophets in his day. "Stop preaching," they say. "Nobody wants to hear the sort of stuff that you want to talk about." But Micah will not stop preaching because he is a genuine prophet, verse 8. "But as for me, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord, and with justice and might to declare to Jacob his transgression, to Israel his sin." Micah has power, not because he is a powerful individual, but because his words are God's words, given him by the Spirit, and therefore they are true words. And so although his message is not popular, a message of sin is never what people want to hear, Micah will stand strong and assured. Now, we just need to think a little bit about how this applies to us. And we need to think, I think, quite carefully about how verses like these apply to us now. Because we are all God's spokespeople as Christians. Living after Christ and after Pentecost, we all have the Spirit. We all have His Word. And so the challenge here is not just to the preacher, it's not just to the church leader. It is, I think, to each and every one of us as Christians here this morning. How much is what we will say governed by what we think we will get in return? How much is the God we are willing to hold before people, the true and living God? And how much is it the God we think that people want? There are plenty of ways there's plenty of ways that society will ensure that we're fed, will ensure that we're looked after, if we're prepared to deliver the right message. You'll be more popular. You'll get invited to the parties, to the dinners. You'll get to keep your job. They'll let the church keep their seats in the House of Lords. If you're the right sort of Christian, they might even invite you on Strictly. Oh yes, people will say, we'll like you, we'll be your friend if you don't say things we don't want you to. But we must not be like the bogus prophets of Micah's time, who spoke from their own stomach and not by God's Spirit. We must not speak on those terms, and we must not be those who are willing to only hear on our own terms either. Which brings us to the third portion of this miserable portrait in verses 9 to 12. Let me read from verse 9. Hear this, you leaders of Jacob, you rulers of Israel, who despise justice and distort all that is right, who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with wickedness. Her leaders judge for a bribe, her priests teach for a price, and her prophets tell fortunes for money. Here Micah brings together the kind of the sum total of the human authority in the land, the leaders, the rulers, the priests, the prophets. And he shows us what they all have in common. And that is an interest first and foremost, not in what is right for the people, but what is profitable for them. It is a system not built on God's law as it ought to have been, but on bribery and corruption. And this is human leadership. It is a starkly bad example of it, sure, but at the level of fundamentals, this is what human leadership is like. This is what it does. This is what happens when people are in charge. Almost 3,000 years later, there is no change in that regard. You wouldn't have to travel very far in the world to find places where a description like this wouldn't sound at all exaggerated today, and you would find plenty of such places around the globe. Even in places like the UK, where we are fortunate to have much less bribery and corruption, that is because the system over the years has built up in such a way that it does a more effective job of keeping a lid on it. Not because the issue has gone away in people. And of course it does still happen, and it will keep happening. In politics, in business, in sport, across society. That's why every so often the cover gets pulled back on some area of the nation's life and we have a scandal. People were really shocked by the parliamentary expenses scandal a few years ago. That the MPs were actually not in it for pure motives, but in lots of cases in it for what they could get out of it. We were shocked, but we really shouldn't have been. People are seemingly really shocked now by the sexual assault scandal in, in Hollywood and in Parliament and who knows elsewhere. But sadly, we really shouldn't be. Where people have opportunity, not all people, of course, and not all of the time, but generally, where people have opportunity to exploit a position of power for their own gain, that is what they do. And yet there is something especially bleak about what is going on in Micah 3. Because, of course, these aren't just any old people. They aren't just any old leaders. They are the leaders of God's people. And it is because of that, because they think that therefore they know God, they presume it will all be fine. That's why in the second half of verse 11, Micah can say, they look for the Lord's support and say, is not the Lord among us? No disaster will come upon us. God's on our side, they say. We're God's people. We're untouchable. They bank on the fact that God will overlook their sin because they wave him like a magic wand. They wear him like a talisman. But they don't know God. That's the problem. They know a fabricated version of him. They know an idol of their own warped imagination. And to choose such falsehood over truth, to think that you can escape the consequences of sin because you're relying on a God of your own invention, well, that is disastrous, as we see in verse 12. Therefore, because of you, Zion will be plowed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble. The temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. Now, how ought people to respond to a message like that? Well, interestingly, Micah 3 verse 12 is quoted elsewhere in the Bible. It's quoted about 100 years later. In fact, in Jeremiah chapter 26, Jeremiah, writing about a century or so later, or speaking about a century or so later, finds his life is threatened. His life is threatened because he does just what Micah is doing here. He tells the people in Jerusalem that because of their sin, judgment is coming. And they're furious. They don't want to hear a message of judgment. And so they decide to kill Jeremiah. Let me read just a few verses. You don't need to turn to it. Let me read just a few verses from Jeremiah 26. At the point at which they are about to kill him, some of the elders of the land stepped forward and said to the entire assembly of the people, Micah of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. He told all the people of Judah, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Zion will be plowed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble. The temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. Did Hezekiah, king of Judah, or anyone else in Judah, put him to death? Did not Hezekiah fear the Lord and seek his favor? And did not the Lord relent so that he did not bring the disaster he pronounced against them? We are about to bring a terrible disaster on ourselves. Micah speaks these words, and Hezekiah hears him. He hears God's word through Micah, and he recognizes that a word of coming judgment from God is not to be ignored. It's not to be edited out, because it doesn't fit the kind of picture of God that we would like. They're not to say, no, disaster will come upon us, because we've decided it so. No, Hezekiah recognized that it required a response. And so Hezekiah repented. And having repented, the Lord relented. Judah as a whole, in fact, was not spared judgment in Hezekiah's day. But Jerusalem was. The city was spared. Thanks to Hezekiah's faithfulness, the remnant of God's people were preserved. So today, when we hear God, when we know God as he truly is, and we recognize him to be uniquely true and just, and so we recognize that he will punish sin, because he must, we also need to recognize that he longs to save from it. That he seeks not simply to destroy the world that we have wrecked, but to utterly transform it. Which, as we close, leads us into chapter 4. I don't know if you noticed when Aaron read the link between 3 verse 12 and 4 verse 1. Therefore, because of you, Zion will be ploughed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble. The temple hill, a mound overgrown with thickets. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established. These are two words concerning exactly the same place. The temple hill, the temple mound there in Jerusalem. Which means these two verses, these two sections, slot together like a before and after shot. You get used to them now. If you remember during the hurricane season, with all those terrible hurricanes in the Caribbean and Houston, Florida, and elsewhere, the BBC loved to put together a kind of a compare and contrast before and after shot, where you can actually sort of just slide the thing across and in exactly the same location. You see before where it was lush and green and verdant, and then afterwards there is nothing but desolation that the hurricane has left in its wake. Well, Micah 3 verse 12 and 4 verse 1 are just like that, but in reverse. A picture of total devastation and emptiness in Zion in 3 verse 12. That is the legacy the leaders leave behind. Ploughed like a field, a heap of rubble, overgrown with thickets. And yet under God, we see in chapter 4, it will become the greatest place, the greatest attraction you could ever dream of. What we're given in 4:1 to 5 is a kind of wide-angled vision of the future. This is a prophecy which is partially fulfilled, I think, in the coming of Christ, who himself is the true temple, who himself draws all nations to himself, but will be fully fulfilled when he returns. A future in which God's true rule, God's true law, God's true word is what characterizes the place, where God alone and God unique is in charge. Micah says that's what people from all over the planet will come for, so that they may be taught by him, so that they may hear from him, so that they may know his justice, so that he may settle disputes between peoples, so that they may know him. It is God, Yahweh, is the big draw in Micah 4. And so as they come, Micah can describe for us this great populous people enjoying peace and justice, prosperous rest, each under their own vine, each under their own fig tree, without fear. And where all enjoy the benefits, not the select few. You see, Micah isn't a prophet all about judgment. He is a prophet all about God. And so this is an invitation to his hearers. Then, now, to all people, to all nations, an invitation to come to God. An invitation which declares that unlike the broken shadows of leadership which we know now, and the fruit of agony and inequality which it leaves behind, this is what Yahweh is like. And this is what life with him is like. And there is none like him. I'm going to read these verses again for us in just a moment. And I'm going to leave a few moments of quiet for us each to come to God in prayer. to repent where we need to, where there are things in this morning or in our lives which we know we need to deal with, and then to give thanks. To give thanks that these verses do not describe a pipe dream, but a kingdom. And that by Christ, we will be there. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war any more. Everyone will sit under their own vine and each under their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid. For the Lord Almighty has spoken. All the nations may walk in the name of their gods, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever." Let's just take a few moments. Well, we are not there yet, but God in his strength and in his love and grace will surely lead us there. That's what we're going to stand and sing about now. "Guide me, O my great Redeemer." Let's stand and sing together.